A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome, or even welcome back, I should say, to the Times Business Podcast, where we're going to be taking a look ahead to some of the events that are going to be moving markets and shaping investment decisions over the coming days. I'm Robert Miller. This week, that means an update on what we all need to know as Britain prepares to leave the European Union, when the Bank of England might start to raise interest rates, and that leads us neatly on to the forthcoming meeting of the US Federal Reserve. To help us make sense of it all, I'm joined by Bruno Waterfield, the Times correspondent in Brussels, and here in the studio by Tom Knowles, our economics correspondent, and Marcus LaRue, the trade correspondent of the Times. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being here. Bruno, if we could start with you, and let's just listen to a clip here from the EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. This is his recent annual State of the Union address to the European Parliament. This is what he had to say.
March 29th, 2019, that will be the date where the United Kingdom will leave the European Union. This will be a very sad and tragic moment in our history. We will always regret this, but, and I think that you will regret it as well soon, if I might say. Nonetheless, we have to respect the will of the British people. But we are going to make progress. We will keep moving. We will move on because Brexit isn't everything. It's not the future of Europe. It's not the be-all and end-all.
Bruno, what are we to make of that? Is it a fond farewell or is it a sign of troubled times ahead, really, for Britain in particular?
Well, I think you've got to put yourself in his shoes. This is a guy for the EU. It's his lifelong project. He described it as, earlier on during a speech, as being like a passionate love affair, always disappointing, but you never lose your love, is how he put it. So from his point of view, he has to believe that Britain will regret being inside the European Union. And when, you know, Michel Barnier talks about people learning the benefits of customs union, that exciting, joyful concept, and the single market, after Brexit, they'll learn what they really mean. That's, again, the same kind of viewpoint. They have to believe that when Britain leaves, there will be regrets over some of the new obstacles and barriers that may or may not be placed in Britain's way when Britain is outside these legal structures. He was today on Euronews debating rather woodenly with some young YouTubers who all looked to be about 7 years old. And he said that he had no hard feelings. It wasn't about revenge and he wanted the future relationship to be a good one. So, yeah, I think there's an element of people would really like, and the British have always got on everyone's nerves by being rather cynical and transactional about the EU. They would like the Brits to one day sort of get on their knees or to deliver a heartfelt plea saying, oh, we've really regretted leaving, we miss you, we miss these wonderful institutions, can we come back? I don't think it was really sort of motivated by any kind of vengeful feeling. I think he was sincere when he spoke of his regret over what he calls the tragedy of Brexit.
It always strikes me, Bruno, that there's an element of lost in translation when Juncker or Barnier says, or Macron says, Britain can't be allowed to cherry pick, can't be allowed to be better off outside the single market and the EU than it was inside. What they seem to be saying to the European audience is Britain becomes a third country, it's simple, they've chosen to leave, there are repercussions. And what Britain quite often hears, by contrast, is we will punish you for having the temerity to leave. And I suppose there is a fine distinction between those two positions, but a real one.
I think a lot of it is the sort of Remainer contingent in Britain would quite like voters to be punished for having the temerity to vote against the great and good. So they always hear that punishment aspect in comments, whether it's by Macron or Juncker.
It's interesting, certainly on the economics front, you know, the Eurozone is looking now like the girlfriend that you split up with, thinking that you get off better on your own, and then you see in a shopping centre and she looks amazing and you're in, you know, your pyjamas or something. I mean, GDP growth in the Eurozone was up 0.6% in the second quarter, whereas the UK was the lowest of anywhere in the European Union at 0.3%. Unemployment's down to the lowest since 2009. Italy, still considered the sick man of Europe, posted growth at 0.4% for three consecutive quarters, which is the first time that's happened since 2010. Spain's doing well. France is booming with Macron, or at least to begin with. So I think that's another thing that, you know, there's also this kind of sense that perhaps Eurozone is suddenly doing better just as we're starting to dwindle. So I guess that adds this sentiment of feeling like, you know, wondering whether people made the right decision or not.
There's a leave equivalent of the phenomenon that Bruno highlighted, which is, you know, some Remainers seem to want to see Britain falter so they can, you know, smugly say, I told you so. The other side of that are the leavers who confidently predicted that there'd be a run on the European Union, that there'd be a wave of populist revolt. And we heard Nigel Farage say yesterday, after Juncker's speech, that, oh no, the populist wave hasn't subsided, it's only just beginning, and there's still this desire to see the whole European project and especially the Eurozone crumble, when the data, at least for the moment, looks like it's pointing in the opposite direction. I don't know if that bears out with what you see slightly closer to European matters, Bruno.
I think I would be cautious about the complacency in the Eurozone at the moment. They have got some good metrics, and it's about time too. I mean, it's also the fact that Eurozone recovery trailed every other region of the world after the financial crisis. At the last summit in June, they had a rather enthusiastic discussion about how well the Eurozone was doing, and they were all sitting around the summit table with a sort of rather post-coital glow. And Mario Draghi, who's very abrasive sometimes, basically told them or tried to strip the rosy spectacles from their eyes by saying that actually, there are problems with productivity. A lot of the jobs are of a lower quality than the jobs that they replaced, and lower wages too. That investment rates are not good, that there are still far too many non-performing loans in Eurozone banks. And he basically castigated them and told them that unless they got their act together and actually improved the underlying trends in Europe's economy, that the Eurozone sort of glow would fade. Particularly with the taper of quantitative easing that we're expecting sometime this autumn into next year.
And it's a fair point that if Germany and France and perhaps Ireland are, you know, lying in bed puffing on a Gauloise, then, you know, Greece and Italy are sort of falling over by the door trying to get their shoes off. You know, it's not a homogenous picture across the Eurozone by any stretch, is it?
No, I think it isn't. And I think a bit like Britain, I think Brexit sort of strips away some of the illusions that people had in the British economy, the great British miracle, by drawing out and highlighting some of its underlying problems. And the people who I talk to, much more hard-headed people around the ECB, but also in the Commission as well, are still very much alive to the fact that, yes, they're going for a good moment, but they do still have these underlying problems. And a lot of the structural reforms that have been urged as absolutely critical, not just in the economy, but in the banking sector, well over the last 10 to 5 years, a lot of those reforms have still not yet been implemented or even agreed. So, you know, I think there's still some hard debates to be had in the Eurozone, and I think we will see some of those emerge after the German elections at the end of this month.
Do you think, though, Bruno, this idea about economic reform and how Mario Draghi has laid it on the line, The first president of the ECB, Wim Duisenberg, always said that. Is there any sign of progress? He said structural reforms must be implemented in each individual Eurozone economy. We haven't seen a great deal of that, have we, since it was formed?
No, we haven't. And I think, you know, possibly as in other areas of the world, you know, quantitative easing has allowed people to avoid the issues that they were supposed to confront. And actually, again, that has been, as with probably all ECB presidents, but it's been a constant refrain from Draghi, who has actually acknowledged some of the concerns of the Bundesbank, for example, that QE would help governments avoid difficult decisions. So I think whatever happens with the Eurozone, I think it will carry on to do well over the next year, although it is very dependent on headwinds elsewhere. I do think some of these debates, much more hard-headed and much more realistic debates, are going to come to the fore.
That kind of takes us back to Monsieur Juncker, doesn't it? I mean, in the sense that if there does need to be more banking union, more monetary union, some kind of political, you know, institutional arrangement to back up the Eurozone, then it's kind of easier to do with without the UK in the room and without a very large economy sitting outside the Eurozone.
Possibly. I mean, again, it'll be interesting to see how that works out, and it'll be interesting to see how the relationship between Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron sort of pans out. I mean, so far they've sort of kissed a bit, but they haven't really sort of got into bed with each other in terms of making a sort of a unified set of Eurozone proposals. So we'll see. I think, again, people are waiting to see how that pans out. Will it be the case that Britain being outside the EU makes the Eurozone any easier at all? I'm not so sure. I think the jury's completely out on that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
So how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, before we move on from that kiss between Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron, let's move on to one of the keynote events that's going to happen in the coming days is, of course, the US Federal Reserve's monthly meeting, followed by Janet Yellen's press conference. Tom, I'm going to ask you first for your thought, but let's listen to a clip of the last time the Fed chairwoman updated the markets when she gave her semi-annual testimony on Capitol Hill in July.
It appears that the recent lower readings on inflation are partly the result of a few unusual reductions in certain categories of prices. These reductions will hold 12-month inflation down until they drop out of the calculation. Nevertheless, with inflation continuing to run below the committee's 2% longer-run objective, the FOMC indicated in its June statement that it intends to carefully monitor actual and expected progress toward our symmetric inflation goal.
Tom, as steady as she goes, but I suppose what we all really want to know is how likely is it that the US Federal Reserve are going to raise rates again this year?
I was just slightly almost distracted by how great Janet Yellen's accent
she
is. It's such a brilliant accent, isn't it?
Yeah. I think I just pinned her down. She's a female Woody Allen, if Woody Allen didn't
yes.
have jokes.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. But, you know, dealing with the most powerful economy in the world rather than director movies is perfect. It looks like they will continue to with their plan to hike interest rates in December, even though inflation is, you know, struggling to push up. Jobs, employment is nearly full in America. And recently we just had actually the latest inflation measure for the US in the Consumer Price Index, and that rose by 0.4% compared with the previous month and 1.9% compared with the year earlier. So that was a bit better than perhaps some were expecting. So I think they will just, you know, carry on steady as she goes. Janet Yellen is possibly not going to be replaced as chair when she steps down next year. It's up to Trump. She's also lost Stanley Fischer, who was like a very keen ally of hers. A couple more Fed members have stepped down. So what's going to be quite interesting is Trump will have quite a big say in how he sort of models the US Federal Reserve. So that's also something to look out for. But I think, yeah, December, we can expect another hike in rates.
Bruno, over there, I mean, there's not a dissimilar dilemma, is there? You've touched on it already with the European Central Bank. They're going to have to take away all that lovely lolly and start making us all see sense. Looking at the two people that we've just talked there about, Trump's interference, the political interference in the Fed, is it the same situation with the ECB, or do you feel there's a bit more continuity there?
I think there is continuity. Things are going quite well, as we were talking about. So I don't think the knives are out for the ECB and Draghi at all at the moment. Very much the opposite. There are going to be some difficult choices. I mean, European governments, indebted European governments, have saved around $1 trillion in financial costs due to the QE. Most of them are still in deficit, as Draghi would say. Most of them haven't carried out the reforms they were supposed to. So can they take a rate rise? Can those governments absorb a 1% increase in rates, for example, and can many European companies as well? So it brings us back again, I think, to a discussion about some of those underlying trends, falling rates of public investment, for example, in Germany, that are a source for concern.
I suppose one of the big differences between the two situations is that in the States you have fiscal policy that's poised for a big expansion, with Donald Trump ready to, well, at some point get around to spending $1 trillion in infrastructure and cutting taxes, despite, you know, Steve Bannon having an excellent stage right. Whereas in the Eurozone and in the EU, there's little sign of Germany putting its hands in its pockets and spending on infrastructure, that, you know, the sort of the deficit aversion and the aversion to spending public funds in Germany is dragging down the rest of the European economy and hindering this transition from extraordinarily loose monetary policy to something that's a bit more normal and a bit more balanced between fiscal and monetary policy.
Tom, do you think, I mean, looking at it as the economics correspondent, that either side of the Atlantic, if you like, or looking into the continent, that at the moment we are all living in a fool's paradise, and however much money you pump in at the end of the day, if we can't, either in Europe, Britain or America, be self-sufficient, we are still storing up trouble for ourselves, and interest rates and monetary policy can only do so much.
Oh, I don't know if I agree with that. I think, you know, these are very useful, powerful tools that are brought out in emergency periods. And I guess the problem is, are we keeping them, these emergency tools, for too long? There's an argument to say that the negative interest rates that the ECB installed have done a huge amount of good, but perhaps quantitative easing is a bit of a false premise. I mean, I think it's actually very, very difficult to control, you know, how inflation works and to push it up towards just under 2%, as the ECB always wants it to be, which they've struggled with so far. So, and not being helped by the euro massively appreciating at the moment. But no, I think it is useful. I mean, you know, going on to the Bank of England, this is another question. What happens if we put interest rates up a little bit. I don't think consumers would be that bothered, but if they start hiking it massively, then that could cause real problems,
especially for young people, presumably, who it's almost like a generation have never known an interest rate rise now.
Yeah,
young people like yourself, Tom,
like myself. Yeah, I'm trying to. When was it? When was the last time
they raised interest? There, all right,
it was about a decade
there.
Ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah. I was at university. I mean, a recession didn't really affect us. We were all poor as students. So, you know, you hardly knew what was going on.
Bruno, a final thought from you. I mean, I'm going to ask each of you, but looking ahead to the final quarter, if you're an investor, are you confident, cautious, or just downright scared?
I wouldn't be hiding my head under the covers, but I really would be hoping that some of these big economic questions, the underlying trends, are confronted. Particularly over the next year. And I would be worried, and not so much as an investor, but as a citizen, a voter, and a member of society in Britain or elsewhere, for very, very negative trends in wage growth, which are bound up with productivity questions. I really do not see that it is sustainable for any of the economies in Europe or Britain to have these levels of declining share of income for people who make wealth. I think that's going to be a really, really, really big question in the year to 2 years ahead.
Marcus?
I would be on the pessimistic side. I mean, the way I think of it is, you know, that the British economy is like one of these circus acrobats swinging from one line to another. And for the last year, it's been clinging on to consumer spending, which is about to start tapering off thanks to Brexit and exchange rate weakness. And everybody's assuming that it will seamlessly glide on to the other rope, which is export growth and, you know, some modest revival in British manufacturing, sparked by the same decline in sterling. We haven't seen many signs of that happening in any meaningful way. And there's a lot to make up for. So any stall in the pickup for exports of services and or goods represents a pretty unpleasant gap where consumers are too under the cosh because of Bruno's squeeze on real wages, which is returning, and business spending isn't picking up the pieces.
I'm a little bit more optimistic than that. There's been a lot of surveys recently from the CBI and Purchasing Managers Index, which has suggested that manufacturers are having the best conditions they've seen in years, and they keep reporting these rise in exports. And that's coming into the official figures a little bit more slowly, but it does seem to be picking up. And yes, obviously it can't replace consumer spending, which is and the UK's dominant services sector, which is a much bigger component of our economic growth. But I think there's some positives, perhaps. And even if manufacturers just decide to charge more for their goods rather than make the most of the slump in the pound and export more, that still contributes to their profits, which still contributes to GDP. So a little bit more positive. But I agree with Bruno on wages. This is something that is baffling economists across the Western world, but especially in the UK. You know, we're reaching the highest employment we've ever had on record, unemployment a 42-year low, and yet real wages are still falling. And this looks like real trouble ahead if that doesn't change soon.
I know how you feel. Watch out for financial updates scheduled from Finsbury Food, Shield Therapeutic and others. And of course, the US Federal Reserve decision. You can find out about that and all the other news and analysis online, your phone and your tablet. And don't forget the paper. If you'd like to become a subscriber, you can always sign up at thetimes.co.uk. And then you'll receive our daily morning and lunchtime business bulletins from Richard Fletcher, the business editor. If you want to hear us weekly, you can subscribe through iTunes, and please feel free to post your comments. We'd love to hear from you. My thanks to Bruno Waterfield in Brussels, Tom Knowles and Marcus LaRue here in London. They are on Twitter, so please do follow them. And join us again next week. Thanks for listening.